Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Suquito Supon, and welcome to Shift F1, a podcast about speedy race cars. That, by the way, is Japanese for the moon and a soft-shelled turtle, which is, Rob, roughly analogous to comparing apples and oranges.
Okay. I was wondering. It's a beautiful turn of phrase. I just couldn't parse what it could possibly mean.
Yeah. Rob, they all are. You look up Japanese idioms, you're like, man, this is just like, it's all poetry. But yeah, apples and oranges, sure seems like we've got one class of team and driver and then everybody else. I'm Drew Scanlon. Joining me, Rob Zachney. How are you, Rob?
Not too bad. I think I might have just watched the final nail be driven in the Chicago Cubs season with a really unusual error on a routine fly ball, which I guess makes it unusual, but... I was doing great until then. The Cubs were like just absolutely smoking the best team in the league. And it's like, yeah, they're starting to surge at the right time of the year. And now, as with many sports and the teams I favor, it's just like, well, whose season starts next?
Well, that's the great thing about Formula One. The season doesn't end, Rob.
No, it just loops.
Danny O'Dwyer is on assignment this week. But he'll be back soon. If you are new to this podcast, a very warm welcome to you. And if you are new to Formula One itself, we recommend listening to our preseason primer episode, which assumes no prior F1 knowledge, explains how the sport works and who everybody is. And so if you'd like to go back and listen to that, it's episode 216. Also, the show would not be possible without our audience over at patreon.com/shiftf1, where every month we release bonus podcasts and videos, along with the ad-free version of the podcast. The bonuses cover racing documentaries and films, F1 video games, experiments with other racing series, and a lot of weird things. So if you would like to support the show and get access to all that fun stuff, head over to patreon.com/shiftf1 or click the link in the show notes. Rob, do you want to tell the people what we're recording tomorrow?
Oh my God. So we are engaging with the high stakes world of sailing. And I'm still working out what is technically yachting?
Are these called
yachts?
I don't know. They're catamarans. I don't know what makes.
I'm just wondering if this is what yacht racing has turned into. As design has changed over the years, but yeah, we are going to be watching some boat racing of all things, and some of our audience is very excited about this. People have wanted us to check out, what is the series called?
Sail GP.
People have been pushing for us to check this out for a little bit. I've always enjoyed the broadcasts. The broadcasts are some of like the best in class sports broadcasts I've seen in terms of like real time graphics and presentation. But also, it's a sport I certainly don't know. I followed it a little bit a few years ago, but mostly it was because like watching boats race on the water is cool. And it has strong video game vibes, I think, in terms of presentation as well. Like, there's a lot of times when the camera pulls back and you can easily imagine, it appears to have been rendered, in fact, in a way to sort of make it look video gamey.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I think you we'll get into it, I guess, on the podcast. But I think it's a sport that you need a lot of that, a lot of those graphics. But it's wild in a lot of ways. So I'm very excited to talk to you guys about it and just try to understand what is up with boat racing, because there's a lot of different, there's some similarities and some very different stuff to race cars. So look forward to that if you are a patron. Speaking of patrons, if you would like to get your sponsor sticker on this peer podcast, you can go to patreon.com/shiftf1 and become a title sponsor, such as these fine folks: Agave ATX, Cyphus Training, Turf SCS, at Team Blackjack, Michael Maves, Gordy's Army, at Talking Autos, Olivia Evans, TelemetryDeck.com, FTC, Drew Stewart, Bailey Foot, Abdullah Althani, Jason Chadwick, Abraham Getchell, The Space Above Us Podcast, Bunny Fiend, Snigs, Alex Goucher, Max Voltar, Circuit Demon, Troy Stammer, Umberto Roca, William Romp, Irvine Clinical Research, Lackland the Madden Man, and M Squared Racing welcomes Ellie. Thank you, everyone, for supporting us on the show. And thank you to our title sponsors. And with that, Rob, if I can remember how Danny throws it back to me, I think we just hop right into the Japanese Grand Prix. What do you say?
I believe we do, yes.
And let's just start with the grid. Regular service has resumed. Max Verstappen is on pole. However, sitting next to him for the first time, rookie Oscar Piastri, the first rookie to start on the front row since Lance Stroll in 2017, which, if you'll note, Rob, was 6 years ago. Lando Norris in third, Charles Leclerc in fourth. The Ferraris, interestingly, saved their tires, their soft tires, for one Q3 run, which I thought was interesting. Sergio Perez in fifth, Carlos Sainz sixth, Lewis Hamilton seventh, George Russell eighth, Yuki Tsunoda in ninth, and then Fernando Alonso in 10th. And I think Alex Jakes said that Alonso has been in every Q3 this season, which is very impressive.
Jeez.
Also impressive in 11th place, Liam Lawson in this is now his fourth race. He's really getting a number of races under his belt. Pierre Gasly in 12th, Alex Albon 13th, Esteban Ocon 14th, Kevin Magnussen 15th. Behind him, we've got Bottas, Stroll, Hülkenberg, Zhou Guan Yu, who had some bad luck with traffic in Q1, had to dip onto the grass to avoid some. And then Logan Sargeant, who had even worse luck, crashed in the first few minutes of Q1. And immediately, Rob, I think I and a lot of the commentators said this, a lot of viewers probably said, well, there it goes. There goes his drive for next year. What do you think?
That was my reaction. When that happened, and he just sort of understeers off in the final corner into the into the barriers, I was waving at the TV. I was like, goodbye, Logan. I hope you have a great career somewhere, but I don't see how it could possibly continue here. Anthony Davidson, you know, came on and was like, it just appears to be an unforced driver error in this case. But as luck would have it, James Vowles was the team principal that Sky had on the broadcast this week. And during the race, for a lot of reasons, we didn't end up hearing as much from Vowles as we might otherwise like. But he's always a good interview, and he's very frank about these things. It was striking the degree to which he cut off Crofty and Ant as they sort of teed him up to... the broadcaster's trying to draw you out with mock sympathy, right? Like, oh, it just has to be so horrible for the team, having to rebuild the car. And obviously this is so many cars you had to rebuild with this guy, and really just sort of like teeing him up to sort of, talk about basically the damage that Sargeant has inflicted on Williams. And Vowles pretty aggressively cut that off and shut it down and, expressed that, it was an unfortunate mistake. But they were, he called attention to the fact that Sargeant was pretty much running, door handle to door handle with with his teammate Albin, and you know, he sort of also emphasized that, like, yes, there might be some logistical issues that come up with the replacement of equipment that they've had to do, and where that's going to impact the team, but really sort of brushed off any idea that Williams was going to have trouble developing a car, you know, for next year because of this, or fielding a car for the next races. You know, really, really shut it down and really gave Sargeant a pretty, you know, given the circumstances, a pretty firm vote of support. And, you know, who knows? In F1, they will do that to you one day, and then they will fire you the next day. That's still in the cards. I still think he seems like a long shot to retain his seat, simply because it seems like there are better prospects out there you might be able to go get with the spare Williams seat. But it was striking the degree to which Vowles wasn't having any of it in terms of scapegoating him. And things didn't go well the next day either. I'll just, you know, skip ahead. Like, Sargeant had a bad race. And again, in the aftermath of that, I forget who it is with Williams. Robson? I think it's like the director of performance. Again, sort of shut down anyone trying to fish for throw Logan under the bus comments, and really emphasize the degree to which, like, the team is ready to replace any parts. They've been, the way he put it is, it's unfortunate that Logan's incidents this weekend overshadowed all the progress he's been making, catching up to his teammate. And so I'm not sure he's a dead man walking. But either way, if you compare how pretty much any team on the grid has tended to handle drivers who are habitually struggling, it's really striking the degree to which Williams is not playing that game. They're not scapegoating him, and they're not building up a case for firing him. They may still do it, but it's an interesting approach.
Yeah, I think if they do, I'll think twice about why it was. You know, there may be other circumstances that, you know, you just don't see. You know, interpersonal stuff, things like that, and that's also what we're not seeing. We're not seeing what he is like moment to moment, day to day with the team. His dedication, if that is indeed you know, something that they're looking at for him. I kind of, you know, I think about Yuki Tsunoda a lot this, because that was his rookie season too. He was crashing a lot, making a lot of mistakes, especially in qualifying. So he's still around, and with Red Bull, no less. So yeah, it's not always as cut and dry. So we'll have to see. But yeah, I am really enjoying whenever I get to hear James Vowles talk, because like you said, it's direct, clear, and it's kind of no nonsense. So
he's one of those guys, and Williams under him, you're kind of rooting for them because you're hoping that model of, like, team leadership, and also that sort of no drama and very little gamesmanship approach to being an F1 team principal, you're kind of hoping that can work. So that, you know, so that a positive model can be out there that, you know, can have an influence, as opposed to what I think tends to happen across sport, which is that people who are a little bit sociopathic in their relationship to athletes and colleagues and just very ruthless in their approach to competition and you know, don't really seem to value a lot outside of that. Those folks tend to be the ones who succeed, and their example tends to get elevated and emulated in sports. You're kind of, you know, it's hard not to pull for Vowles and Williams just to offer a counterpoint.
Yeah. Well, should we get to the start, Rob? I've got some notes here, but if you like, you can take it, or I can. Which would you prefer?
Well, I mean, the start was it was one of the more exciting starts for the year in terms of the battle for the lead. Pretty much the whole race. You know, we started, really the race kind of began with just the way they lined up on the grid with Max and Oscar both angling their cars severely toward each other, setting up a game of chicken, declaring intention to try and cut the other off. And indeed, as soon as the lights went out, that is exactly what happened. Max had a good start and was running ahead of Piastri and immediately swept over to the right-hand side of the track to force Piastri to the limits and cut him off from the correct line into turn one, so he'd be forced to slow down and back off. But it seems like that was actually all part of McLaren's plan. The entire thing did feel like an attack that had been discussed in advance, because as Max is doing that, Norris, who started behind him, is racing up to the outside of turn one and appears to have a clean shot at getting around Max on the outside, because Max has been so concerned with trying to cut off Oscar. And so at the last second, Max has to veer back toward the middle of the track to deal with the threat from Norris. And it really seemed like, in terms of the tactic, it basically worked. Like, McLaren's gamble to put the squeeze on Max functionally worked. It just didn't matter, is the problem. Like, once Max was like, oh, I need to get back on the racing line and deal with Lando, he did, and then his car is faster, and then he was gone, and that was basically it. Mm-hmm. In the background of all that, you saw huge lockup and parts going flying. And what was going on there was, you know, it's the stuff that happens in the back of the pack. Basically, Valtteri had ended up in the middle of a pack, but specifically squeezed between Ocon and Albon as they were getting away from the starting grid. And they just ran out of room, and Bottas took a hard hit. His wing got really badly damaged. I think Albon was damaged in that as well. But yeah, it was a moment that, like, it set the Alphas up for what was going to be a tough day, and it left so much debris on the track that it wasn't too much longer before they declared a safety car.
Yeah. Some other bumping and grinding in the back field. Sainz moved into Perez's path, which caused him to drift into Hamilton, bumped wheels, and put Hamilton briefly onto the grass. As far as the rest of that first lap was concerned, the real action in my book is with the AlphaTauris. Tsunoda and Lawson went side by side through what felt like half of the racetrack. Lawson had this amazing late braking job and was able to dart up the inside of one of the corners. Go watch the replay, because it looks like it's like sped up footage or something. It's such a cool move, and the angle and everything just really sells it. That allows him to lead into the next corner on the outside and take the place. But yeah, as you mentioned, safety car for debris from the contact at the start. Perez takes the opportunity to pit for hard tires and new front wing number one. We do restart soon after, and on lap five, Bottas is suddenly facing the wrong way. And on replay, he was hit by none other than Logan Sargeant, who locked up on the inside of a corner. Not a great weekend for old Logan.
No, and you feel bad for both of them, because it's not like Logan, like, I think he picked up the penalty for this, for causing the collision, but it's one of those things where, like, Valtteri was going around the outside of him. It's not like he did something necessarily to cause the collision. He just couldn't make the turn. He wasn't, like, trying a dive. He was being overtaken. He locked up heading into the hairpin, and suddenly there's a car in front of him and he can't steer anymore. He takes out that car. Yeah. It's a little bit of a difference, because I think I'd like to see causing collision penalties when someone is making a proactive choice to, like, take a gamble. It didn't feel like Sargeant was trying to take a dive down the middle. It just felt like he was on the line he'd chosen, and he lost control of the car. With lockup, which just happens, and Valtteri was, like, going around the outside at that moment. But either way, it was sort of a lousy coda to Sargent's awful weekend. He ended up retiring shortly thereafter, right? Like there was damage sustained here that they had to bring him in.
Yeah, Sargent retired. He ended up just being kind of in the back of the grid until lap 22 is when he retired. Bottas, though, now has contact or damage from contact with two Williams cars and retired on lap 9. So they
brought him into the pits, and it's not good when half the crew is lying down next to the car, like trying to see under it and like see how bad the floor is. But yeah.
Yeah. Lap 5, another great battle between teammates, and this one continues. Russell and Hamilton going at it over 7th place. Russell has a great cutback to get Hamilton on the inside, which he keeps with some bold lines through the next couple turns, not giving an inch to his multi-championship winning teammate. But on the main straight, Hamilton slingshots by Russell with DRS and just manages to swoop around the outside into turn 1. To retake the place. I loved this this back and forth.
It was a great duel. I also think it's the first moment where I feel like if you had to sum up how the weekend went for Mercedes, or at least how the race went, it was like damned if you do, damned if you don't. Because I feel like they came out of this race with everyone being unhappy and feeling like the pit wall hadn't made the right calls, both drivers feeling like they gotten screwed by race strategy calls that they hadn't been listened to. And I think kind of starts here. And I think one thing that, like, as good as the duel was, I think the funny thing here is that Hamilton's pace appears to be slightly compromised by that dive plane damage he took with the tag from Perez. At least additional parts appear to be flying off at various points in this duel. And so it looks like Russell might have a bit more pace, and you might think, like, it does make sense maybe to release him and let him run on ahead. But at the same time, he couldn't close the deal. You know, if it turns out he did have a little more pace, he didn't have so much that he could actually run away from Hamilton, and Hamilton was able to gather him up again. And so you get Russell on the radio saying, are we fighting each other? Or are we going to fight the other teams effectively? Calling for, you know, basically kind of running the teacher to sort of say, like, hey, like, you should let me go ahead and take the fight, you know, to the team, to the guys running ahead of us, and we should sort of work together here. And Mercedes kind of don't really. It seemed like they just kind of didn't respond at this juncture. They're kind of letting things play out.
I mean, they kind of did. I think they pitted Hamilton right around that time, and they did not pit Russell. So they split the strategy. And are just leaving Russell out there to do a one stop, where Hamilton pits on lap 16, goes from medium to hard tires, intending to do a two stop. But before that happens, Sergio Perez damages another front wing with, and I think it's the same place where Sargent and Bottas came together, a very late lunge up the inside of Kevin Magnussen, connecting with his rear left and spinning him 180 degrees. Also very similar to his move on Albon last week in Singapore. So I don't know what is going on over there,
dude. So two things can be true. I think we can have a lot of sympathy for where Perez is at with his team, and knowing, you know, based on kind of what Marco's comments, like how we know he's viewed by some of the folks in the management, and the lenses through which some of those folks view him, and the lack of support he got. You can have a lot of sympathy for that.
Yeah.
Also, at the same time, this shtick is getting old for him as a driver. Like, I think he has always had tendencies to initiate contact a little more than you want to see in an F1 driver, and tendencies to just, like, take risks that are just, they're too low percentage to try and stick. This weekend, between this race and last race, though, I think the thing that shifted is his judgment appears to be actively bad. That, and he just kind of can't drive the car. We saw him struggle with the same corner a couple times. He couldn't negotiate that hairpin to save his life this weekend. But it's this combination of just bad judgment, not coming to grips with the car, and he is out there pinballing off people and teams who are sort of fighting for meaningful points in the championship. It was kind of exasperating.
Yeah. Yeah. He is signed for through 2024. So it doesn't strike me as desperation necessarily. You'd think like he's got a decent lead, in second in the championship going into this race. You don't need to take a lot of risks, but, I don't know. In any case, he retires on lap 15, albeit temporarily.
Yeah, so this is the thing. So, and this comes up post race a little bit, because he just starts picking up penalties in all of this, because like these are clear. He is causing collisions. He picks up penalties for that. I think he also picks up one for overtaking under the safety car. He's just sort of a penalty generating machine. He overtook someone diving into the pit lane under the safety car. And so like he's racking up penalties, he's tagging a lot of drivers, he's taking a lot of damage. But at the end of it, he's got this penalty sitting out there, I think, for this contact with Magnussen, this 5-second penalty, but they retire the car. And then they eventually later in the race, they decide to put him back out so he can, like, much later in the race, so he can go out there, come in for a pit stop, serve his 5 seconds, come in, retire the car, and that way it's clean slate next week. And this triggered some discussion among the drivers after the race. Albon and Magnussen were both as nice as they could be about it, but both of them, in so many words, kind of said enough of this. And Albon specifically called out that these 5-second penalties are not cutting it, which feels like it might be a talking point for the entire season. The 5-second penalty is like very much a worthwhile cost of doing business if you can gain track position and just leave someone in the dust. But then the other thing is, obviously, Red Bull kind of gamed this so they wouldn't have to carry that penalty forward. But the point Albon makes is, if 5-second penalties were meaningful, stick, Perez wouldn't still be doing this. But Albon's like, Albon said, I'm watching him do this. Like, he did to me. I turn around and watching him do it to Magnussen. Like, it's not working. This is not encouraging him to raise his driver standards. They talked to George Russell after the race, because he wears that other hat as the head of the Grand Prix Drivers Association. Mm-hmm. And he kind of admitted that they might need to revisit this, because they're, in general, the paradigm has been they don't hand out penalties based on the severity of the incident, the consequences of the incident. You just sort of look at it in a vacuum, and no matter what the stakes were or the impact it has on someone else's race, you just kind of treat like a collision is a collision is a collision. And that's 5 seconds. And Russell did kind of acknowledge that there are times it might behoove the marshals to consider the impact it has on other people's races. And he used himself as an example, which is that I think he called out last year a really sketchy incident he caused with Carlos. And he was like, honestly, that was probably worth more than 5 seconds. So maybe we do need to talk about like how we measure these things. So I feel like the 5-second penalty wrist slap that we've seen handed out a lot this year may not be long for this world in its current form, because it's not causing people to straighten up and fly right. And also, if you get screwed and you see someone just eat that penalty and drive on unimpeded, that's not going to sit well.
Well, back to the race here. Some good moves from the Ferraris around lap 20 or so. Leclerc gets by Ocon for fifth into Spoon Curve on lap 19. Lap 20, Sainz gets by Alonso for seventh place. And then some more Hamilton, who is looking racier than we have seen from him in a while, frankly. Lap 21, he drafts up behind Alonso and then goes for it on the inside of 130R at a very high rate of speed. I thought this was a really cool move.
Is this after Alonso is like, you guys threw me to the wolves?
I think so.
Because I feel like this came after Alonso was real unhappy with the placement he had following a pit stop, and that he'd been thrown to the wolves. And Yeah, it was, but it was great watching Hamilton get this done. You know, his form's really been good lately.
Yeah. Lap 27, Norris, having lost out to Piastri in the pits, closes up to his teammate and is calling over the radio for a swap since he is much faster. And after a while, Piastri does move over. More pit stops happen around lap 35. Hamilton undercutting Sainz, who, you know, Sainz is, it's like he's becoming the new Vettel. He's got like these eyes in the back of his head, like he knows when he's just been undercut. Russell, by this point, has made it up to third, having started in eighth since he's on that one-stop strategy. However, Norris, having stopped just for the second time, gets past him on lap 38, and then his teammate Piastri follows suit on lap 42, stacking the podium places with two McLarens. Leclerc gets by Russell on lap 45 for fourth place, and we get a great visor cam view of this pass into turn one. Very, very good. And while Hamilton is behind Russell in six, he did stop a second time. So on lap 49, Russell is told to move over for Hamilton, which is a tricky thing because Sainz is right behind Hamilton. So what Mercedes doesn't want to happen is for Russell to slow down too much and also give up a place to Sainz, to which Russell says, all right, great. How about we do this on the last lap so that Sainz doesn't have as much time to overtake me? But then the engineer comes back and says, it's an instruction, George.
So, again, this is where this conversation comes to a head on lap 49, but it's been building because Hamilton's been there, like, you know, on his gearbox for a minute. And, again, probably the, like, Hamilton certainly was making the argument, like, hey, Hamilton thought he had pace to go challenge Leclerc up ahead. And was Leclerc? Sorry,
yeah.
He was convinced that they had pace to go ahead and challenge Leclerc. And the thing that's stopping him from mounting that challenge is being stuck behind his much slower teammate, who's nursing these shot to pieces tires around. And the team doesn't make the call to do that. They don't intervene to unleash Hamilton, even though it does sort of seem like this is sort of one of those clear cut, like, you're on different tire strategies, like, Hamilton's got this pace in hand, let him use it. And so at lap 49, I didn't feel like there was going to be time for him to go get Leclerc. Hamilton still kind of thought maybe that was in the cards. But Hamilton's also saying, we're going to lose both positions if you keep me stuck back here. And George just wanted to do the signs trick. Which great radio message. Sainz calls it out. They're using my trick against me. Just towing your tail gunner along behind you, so that the faster car charging from behind can't get either of you. Because you know, effectively the DRS moots their pace advantage. But yeah, like at this point, Mercedes cuts off the conversation, and Russell's got to do it, even though he may have. That may have been the better play. The one thing I'll say is, I feel like leaving it to the last lap, it's just tricky to execute these swaps. And they do it very cleanly, as it happened. They managed to do it, but it is kind of one of those things where if you get it wrong in the last lap, that might be the whole shooting match. So I can see why they might have wanted to do it now, when it still felt like they had some control over the situation.
Right, because if Russell's ahead and then it's Hamilton, Russell is slowing Hamilton down. And so if Sainz gets past Hamilton, well, then now what do you do?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, so Mercedes tries to execute the Sainz maneuver. It does not work on the master, because just one lap later, Sainz swoops by on the main straight with DRS to take sixth from George Russell. And that's how it finishes. Max Verstappen earns Red Bull their second consecutive Constructors' Championship and their sixth overall. And additionally, this note from racefans.net here, if Perez does not finish at least third in the sprint race at the next event in Qatar, Verstappen will be champion. And if he does finish in the top three, Verstappen will still be champion if he finishes no more than 5 places behind his teammate. So it is very likely that we may see a champion crowned in a sprint race. Second place, though, McLaren's Lando Norris, who, according to F1.com, has finished second for the 4th time in the last 7 races. He now has 10 career podiums without a win, and only 4 other drivers have as many podiums without a victory. That is Nick Heidfeld, Stefan Johansson, Chris Amon, and Romain Grosjean. So, good company. Third place, holds on to the podium, Oscar Piastri, the rookie. Way to go, Oscar. In 4th place, Charles Leclerc. Lewis Hamilton, 5th. This is also from F1.com. Lewis Hamilton's 5th place is his... He has always finished in the top 5 at Suzuka. There's always a lighthouse. There's always Hamilton. We've always been at war with Suzuka. Hamilton's now 33 points behind Sergio Perez in the battle for 2nd in the World Championship. Red Bull have never finished 1-2 in the Drivers' Championship. That was surprising to me. 6th place, Carlos Sainz. 7th place, George Russell. 8th place, Fernando Alonso. 9th place, Esteban Ocon and his teammate Pierre Gasly coming in 10th. Liam Lawson finishes 11th.
Did you catch weirdness with Ocon and Gasly?
No, what's up?
There's a swap around order. And it was because earlier in the race, I guess, they released Gasly, like much earlier in the race. They released Gasly to go ahead since he had more pace and was on a different strategy. And at the end of the race, they were back together again with Gasly leading, and the team ordered a swap around. And Gasly gently lost his shit on the radio, I guess, is how that played out. Ocon, you know, his understanding, and this is the team's line. The team has pretty clear orders about this, and these predate this year. This goes back a bit. If someone does you a favor and moves over and releases you, and then you're together at the end of the race, you have to give that place back. That's sort of the courtesy that is enforced. Now, Gasly's position is, we were on alternate strategies. I had more pace to begin with. I was miles ahead of Esteban. You know, there's no need to do it. There's no justifiable reason to do a swap around. But this is the principle that Alpine follows. So there's a little bit of ill will there at the end behind that 9-10 finish.
Okay. Well, behind them, we've got Liam Lawson in 11th, Yuki Tsunoda in 12th, Zhou Guan Yu 13th, Nico Hülkenberg 14th, Kevin Magnussen 15th, ahead of all the DNFs of Alex Albon, Logan Sargeant, Lance Stroll, Sergio Perez, and Valtteri Bottas. Gosh, I don't even remember what happened to Lance Stroll.
Like random rear end damage. Like pulled into the pits, they did a visual inspection and like signaled to kill the car. But I couldn't. Right, I never did go back and because it was like it was kind of further back in the pack anyway. Like so much, you just kind of assume they're just all part of the same carnage. But I never did loop back around to figure out like what caused Stroll's damage.
Yeah, not sure. Well, that's Japan, and that is it for the race recap. We're going to take a break here, and then we'll be back with the news. And we're back. Welcome back. Before we get to the news, driver standings after the Japanese Grand Prix. Max Verstappen is on top. Big surprise there. Sergio Perez, he has 400 points. That is 177 points ahead of the second place driver, Sergio Perez. And there are 180 points left up for grabs in the season. So that's how that Qatar math is working out. Lewis Hamilton is in third with 190 behind Sergio Perez's 223. That's 33 points. Fernando Alonso is in fourth with 174. Carlos Sainz in fifth with 150. Charles Leclerc in sixth with 135. And then a tie between Lando Norris and George Russell in seventh and eighth with 115 points. Oscar Piastri in ninth with 57. Lance Stroll in 10th with 47. Pierre Gasly's got 46. Esteban Ocon's got 38. Alex Albon has 21. Nico Hülkenberg has 9 in 15th place. Valtteri Bottas with 6. Zhou Guanyu's got 4. Yuki Tsunoda and Kevin Magnussen both have 3. And Liam Lawson has 2. And then tied for 20th place, Logan Sargeant, Nick DeVries, and Daniel Ricciardo. In the constructor standings, Red Bull Racing has secured the championship, the team, the constructors championship, that is, with 623 points. Mercedes is currently in second with 305. Ferrari's in third with 285. Aston Martin has 221. McLaren thinks they can beat them by the end of the season. They have 172 points. Alpine's in sixth with 84. Williams has 21. Gene Haas and team have 12. Alfa Romeo's got 10. And Alfa Tauri with 5. If you would like to join the standings yourself, you can join our fantasy league using the link in the show notes. You can still get in before the end of the season, because not only is there an overall winner, there is also winners per race. And the podium positions from the Japanese Grand Prix are, in third, LeGreg's Gunners. In second, Strulovich's Red Balls. And in first place, Papaya and Blue Scuderia. But overall, it's as you were for the overall podium. Because in third, we have Time to Call underscore Gene. In second, Horner to the Max. And in first, that's right, Paying the Stroll Toll. Lance Stroll getting a lot of love in the team names over here. Let's take it to the news. Sorry, go for it, Rob.
No, do we call that love?
The news, couple big notes. Driver wise, AlphaTauri is keeping Yuki Tsunoda and, drum roll please, Daniel Ricciardo. So Liam Lawson, despite his very good performances, will have to take a back seat and wait one more year. Who knows? Languish in obscurity forever.
This is a larger sample size than we have with DeVries, right?
Yeah. No. I think DeVries had more. Oh, wait. You mean before?
Before he got the job.
Before he got the job. Yeah, I think he won maybe 2 races. DeVries raced.
I'm just saying, like, I can understand not wanting to burn your fingers twice on like the same thing, where it's a substitute driver comes in, looks good. You're like, the hell with it. Let's sign him. Liam Lawson looks like he has the stuff. You know, who knows how much of it, but he's in there going wheel to wheel with Yuki at a track that Yuki has a lot of experience at. And like Lawson,
to be fair, so does Lawson, because he's Super Formula.
Hmm. I think they're commenting that Lawson didn't. Maybe it was Sargeant, the other rookie that.
It was Singapore that Lawson had never raced at, I think.
Okay. Then that makes that duel a little more even, I guess, in terms of how the drivers come across there. But yeah, I don't know. It just seems like Lawson appears to be a very good and steady hand behind the wheel, and I'm sort of surprised that they didn't try to find something for him, unless, I mean, Sergio's on the last year of his contract. How secure is that seat?
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I think, which is why there's an article from racer.com. Liam Lawson, not distracted by the news he won't be an AlphaTauri racer in 2024. I don't think I would be either. I think I would be, as these things go, relatively content, because if I'm him, I have just put in some incredible performances. And even if Red Bull doesn't pick me up, I'm also like open for business. Yeah. Because not only did he, you know, perform well, he performed well in an AlphaTauri. Like that same kind of deal with DeVries, where, you know, he was in that Williams and just completely outshone Latifi.
Yeah, it's been an impressive outing. Like, and it appears like they are, I'm not sure what his full contract status is, but, you know, this quote from him on Red Bull Driver, it doesn't seem like they're going to, you know, release him into the broader pool of F1 talent and say, like, go find yourself a ride. So, I don't know. Like, to me, the whole, we're keeping Ricciardo around, like, to me, it just all indicates that the seat's going to be scorching hot for Perez next year. And I'm curious how I, like, where the contract is at. But, you know, with 1 year left, you're willing to eat penalty terms if things are not working out well, because you basically only owe on the balance of a season if you end up having to shut down a contract early. So, yeah, like, to me, it's odd that, like, Lawson isn't getting tapped for something. And the fact they're keeping, you know, Ricardo around as well just indicates that there may be a broader shuffle in play. So, yeah, it's interesting, but I don't know. I've been really impressed with Lawson. I don't feel like, you know, it's just a hype thing that he's sort of the new shiny object. Like, I feel like we've seen enough here that if this guy weren't ready to be an F1 driver, we would have seen more evidence of that.
Yeah. Ricardo, by the way, still no sign of when he's going to be back. It was just this week they were saying that, let's see here. Yeah, he's still, they don't want to put a deadline on the recovery. They just want him to recover well. No telling when he's going to be back in the seat. I guess, now that he's signed for next year, he can take his time. Who cares?
Yeah, give Lawson some more reps. And, I think this is a situation where if I'm Ricardo, I'd be okay letting the thread play out and come back after you're properly rehabbed. And Lawson, like, what a great situation, really. You come in unexpectedly in a situation where nobody expects very much of you. You do well. And then if he finds himself driving again next year, it is once again the backup quarterback thing where it's like the most popular man in town, because he'll be coming into a situation where something has happened where it's kind of messy, and Lawson is there to, you know, be the alternative. So I think he's in a great position.
As for Tsunoda, got some quotes here from racefans.net from chief race engineer Jonathan Edels, who said, Yuki is, where is the quote? Yuki is maturing. He's focusing on understanding the car, giving better feedback. He's maturing as a driver, and that's helping us focus on the areas to help him get faster. I think he's also understanding more what he needs from the car in terms of balance, characteristics, the interestability, all these sorts of things. Before, he was still learning, and he went through the changes regulations, and us as a team as well, we know how to extract the most from him based on the data, his feedback. So I think we're gelling as a group, and that is showing in his performance. So if graph go up, I guess.
I think the problem I see the problem I see with Yuki, or for him really, is that I just don't know where he goes, because nothing I've seen indicates that, like, him going up to Red Bull would be good for anyone. I don't think that team has the patience for someone like you, sort of has the tendencies he does. I think, honestly, if you aren't a fluent English speaker, I think that team just gives off bad vibes in terms of how you'll be regarded. I don't love it as a destination for him. But I think the big thing is, like, I also just feel like from Yuki, we kind of have a sense of, I'm not sure this is the guy for, like, the high pressure, you have to deliver situation that Red Bull would be. And so I kind of wonder, like, is he on the Gasly plan where it's going to be, you're going to serve out a long stint at Alpha and then we see where you go? Or is it going to be a thing where, are there any leading teams where you see Yuki would be a good fit for where they are at? Are you with me that Red Bull doesn't seem like it would be the place?
Yeah, no, I guess I'm wondering what is giving me that impression. And it's, I can't really point to a lot of Yuki performances, frankly, one way or the other. Like, he used to crash a lot when he was a rookie, and now he's just kind of there. You know, he's fine. Yeah. Like, he's often in Q3 and you're like, oh, great, cool.
But then, that car was a piece of shit this year. That's a good point.
Yeah, like, that too. So
that car might be masking performance gains.
It's true.
But then Lawson was there too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. The other bit of driver news, Oscar Piastri has signed a multi-year extension with McLaren through the end of 2026. So we're going to be seeing him seeing more of him alongside Lando Norri.
Where does Norris's contract run to?
Through 2025.
Okay, so they got them offset by a year.
So far, the last remaining driver to be confirmed next year is Logan Sargeant. He was signed in November of 2022. So we might have to wait that long again.
You know, I think if you could, I'll say this, like Williams has like for a while dealt with we have a badly underperforming second driver situation. Like it's just been a fact of life there. Robert Kubica comes back. He's not who he was as a driver.
How dare you?
You know, Nicky Latifi, nice enough fellow, but like just never could bring it together. I could see it being a thing where if Vowles and company are not BSing and like Sargeant is genuinely showing improvement behind the wheel of an F1 car and like, you know, gaining proficiency, not everyone is actually capable of improving once they get an F1. Like we've seen it, like not everyone can actually raise their ceiling or you know, raise their floor really. Once they get into an F1 drive, the ability to improve is pretty important. Cause we've seen a lot of drivers come in and just not be able to do that. So, you know, maybe they do give him that grace period, for this, given that it's no worse than it's been really.
Yeah. One more contract that I haven't seen come through, and maybe it has, and I've just missed it. Toto Wolff. I have here on my personal sheet that I keep here. He was his last contract was through 2023. So we've seen George and Lewis sign their extension in August. Wonder what's up with old Toto. Let's move on, Rob.
Yeah.
To the FIA.
Yeah. So the FIA, sort of the coming into the weekend, they had gone back and reviewed their handling of some impeding incidents that happened with Max at Singapore. And what they determined was that they'd issued him a reprimand because he was involved in three impeding incidents over the course of the Singapore weekend or in qualifying, one in the pit lane and then two out on track. And they ended up reprimanding him. And then shortly after the race, really, they went back and reviewed that and said that that was a mistake, that they should have given him a three-place grid penalty given the impeding incidents and the fact that that's pretty much a cut-and-dried penalty at this point. Like, they hand those out pretty aggressively when it comes to impeding on the track. So They sort of, you know, put up their hands and admitted that, you know, they're questioned about it because, you know, every team principal, every driver keeps an index of like, well, I didn't get a reprimand. I got the grid penalty. Mm-hmm. So they were pressed on it. They just didn't argue the point. They were very frank about like, it was a mistake. And they further clarified that they weren't setting a new precedent. There is no, like, nobody should be arguing for, well, if Max got a reprimand, I should get a reprimand. It was a flat-out mistake, and the three-place grid drop is the proper penalty for impeding.
I think that, I don't know, I like seeing that. I like seeing the FIA going like, hey, we messed up. I feel like I would like to see more of that, if indeed there are mess-ups in the future. Because I feel like the FIA in you know, since I've been watching that's not really how they roll ever.
No. Generally, they will sort of stand by their rules or just not clarify what their thinking was around an incident. So that is growth of a sort. But not everyone likes growth.
Mm.
As we've discussed basically throughout this year, F1 and F1 team principals hate the idea of teams joining the F1 grid without paying a fortune in anti-dilution fees. And so the punchline to all of this is that I think there were four bids to enter F1 of varying credibility. They didn't all look like prime candidates to come into F1, but doesn't matter. Not some of them did look okay. Doesn't matter. Three of the four have been rejected. So let's see who got knocked out here, because I didn't follow the other entries as closely. So yeah, High Tech from Formula 2 and Rodan Carlin, and then there was a bit of an odd one coming from LKYS Sons. Sort of an odd bid that came in there. I can't remember. One of them also led off with it was going to be, I think they were leading off like a diversity and inclusion pitch for like what the concept of their team was going to be, and that would be their value. That'd be their value add. The odd thing that comes from the Suns refusal is that organization said they were willing to pay a much higher dilution fee, that they had some backing, and that they were ready to sort of meet whatever terms the F1 teams wanted to set down for entry, and they're making it sound like there might still be a chance for them. The team that didn't get rejected is Andretti.
Hmm.
Andretti's still alive. And, all right, this is now just my theory, Drew. They don't like him, but he's obviously a credible bidder, and he'll put together a credible F1 team. And I think they know they can soak him. I think before all is said and done, he is going, like, he will find the backing and the capital to meet a higher anti-dilution fee. I think they know he's going to, like, he'll do it. And they will get their pound of flesh from him. And then they're going to get a pretty decent competitor on the F1 grid that will... You know, I think, you know, they all, you know, the argument they always make is, well, what does any new team add? I think with Andretti and the Cadillac backing, like, it's kind of obvious what it adds. Like, having another credible entrant is always, I think, is just good for the sport. I suspect that, like, if he can scrape together the dilution fee that they're looking for, and I think he wants it badly enough that he'll find a way. I think this will end up happening.
Interesting. Well, we will certainly follow that one whenever there is more information, because that would be interesting. I feel like if it's just some other team that you don't really know, and people may know Carlin and High Tech better than I do, especially if you watch a lot of Formula 2. But I think you're right, Rob. I think having that pedigree just lends a lot more credibility to it. And frankly, it's built in eyeballs. I think if you're coming from Indy, you want to see that. If you're American, you probably heard the Andretti name more than you've heard Logan Sargeant. Yeah. or Haas, frankly. Well, it may not be true because NASCAR. But yeah, we'll be watching.
Send us a note here. Sorry. Yeah. Apparently, part of the brief for all the teams coming from F1 has been part of your bid should indicate how you're going to have a positive social impact, particularly with regard to diversity. So I think one of the interns did really center that, but apparently this is part of the prospectus that F1 has put out there.
All right. Good. Well, if you'd like to send us an email, if you got any inside knowledge on the Andretti situation. Shift F1 Podcast at gmail.com or f1.cool/emails. You can also hit us up on the socials using the links in the show notes. There's too many of them for me to list with my mouth. And that is us around the internet. Now it's time to take it around the world of racing, Rob. The World Rally Championship is in Concepcion, Chile for the Rally Chile Biobío.
Hell yeah.
Biobío. Let's see.
I have no concept of where we are in that championship. Is this the end? Is it the beginning? Do they run through the winter?
I don't know. WRC does have an offset schedule. I think it might start earlier. So this may be toward the end.
There's definitely winter driving, because I've played those games, and there's there'd be snow.
Isn't EA making the next one? I think EA is making WRC.
They wrested it from the French company that has done it for years, and pretty good games, all things considered. But now it is a Codemasters joint, which, you know, people really like Dirt Rally 1 and 2. So, you know, it's probably in good hands.
They like Dirt 2 even more. MotoGP is at the formerly known as Twin Ring Motegi. It is now Mobility Resort Motegi.
No. Bring it back.
In the Haga District, Tochigi Prefecture. The World Superbike Championship is at Autodromo Internacional do Algarve for the Portuguese round. We've got those Craftsman trucks at the Talladega Speedway in Talladega, Alabama for Love's RV Stop 250. Motocross Grand Prix is in Matterley Basin in Winchester for the Motocross Grand Prix of Great Britain. And we got NASCAR also at the hallowed grounds of Talladega for the Yellowwood 500. Yellow with an A.
Of course.
Camel Case Wood 500. And guess what, Rob?
Yeah.
It's not just the raceway that will conjure memories of the 2006 classic film, Talladega Nights, the legend, the ballad of Ricky Bobby. Because Stuart Haas Racing, Gene Haas and team, will be sporting two cars featuring Ricky Bobby and Cal Naughton Jr.'s liveries from the movie. That's right, Wonder Bread and Old Spice will be out on the track. Set your DVRs.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
A NASCAR playoffs to remember.
Thank you, Jalopnik, for cluing me into that one. We're one more week until the Qatar round at the Lusail International Circuit, but until then we'll have to watch all that other racing. And I'll also have to read from Danny's book. He has sent me an image from which to read. September 27th, today in F1 history. Gilles Villeneuve.
You've had to carry so much of the load.
Oh, of course. You can also see this image. Please, Rob, be my guest.
Well, now I'm alarmed because we're leading with Gilles Villeneuve, so I don't know where this is going.
It's okay.
September 27th, Gilles Villeneuve was renowned for his never-say-die attitude in racing, and he once again displayed that quality on this day in 1981 at his home Grand Prix at Montreal, Canada. In torrential rain, Gilles had severely damaged the front wing of his Ferrari. Rather than waste time by pitting to have it sorted out, he drove on with the wing obscuring his view. Eventually, it became detached, and he drove to an impressive third place with the nose section of the car missing. When Damon Hill was looking for a new team for the 1997 season, he told the press he was talking to everyone except Minardi. In the end, he joined the team second to Minardi in the list of all-time F1 losers. Today, in 1996, the British driver surprised everyone when he announced he had signed for perennial backmarkers Arrows. Hill almost took a victory for the team at the Hungaroring, but left after just one winless season.
Wow. So wait.
It seems like somebody at that book took Damon Hill's career decisions personally.
97. That's after he won his championship?
I can't remember.
This is exposing
you don't end up new an F1 fan I am. If your stock is high. But yeah. You can make some bad.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yep. No one. There's no way to know. If you would like to support the show, oh, I'm sorry. Rob, final thoughts on Japan?
It was one of those things where if you lop off what's happening with like the very front of the race, it was a damn good race.
Yeah, certainly interesting from a strategy perspective. All the people running different strategies, undercutting each other. A very F1 nerd kind of a race, I think.
Sorry, quick thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Damon Hill won the championship in 1996.
Okay.
So wait, why is he looking? Why is he going to Arrows in 97?
I have no idea.
Well.
The world may never know. If you would like to support the show and get access to all of our bonus episodes, the ad-free version of the podcast, and the official Shift F1 Discord, you can do so over at patreon.com/ShiftF1. Have a good race weekend, everyone. We will see you all next week.